Welcome to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Swinniger and Matthew Keener.
We're here to talk about some recent news headlines and hopefully provide some insight, analysis, and practical applications that you can take into the office to help you protect your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
Going forward, we're proud to announce that whenever you are listening to the Security Serengeti podcast, you'll be mining Dogecoin for us. We'll be taking 90% off the top for providing you with the mining pool. We will directly mail your Dogecoins to you via the United States Postal Service. It'll be there any day.
Yeah, keep checking your mailbox. All right, the first article we're going to talk about is from Bruce Schneier about the misalignment or misaligned incentives for cloud security. This is an article which appeared on Bruce Schneier's blog, and previously it had been posted in Foreign Policy. And the gist of this article is Bruce's contention that cloud security needs, or cloud providers need to provide more transparency and public accountability in order to match the consequences of failure in those arenas or in those environments. And he has 2 points for why he believes this is necessary. So the first point being that cloud security is increasingly becoming the default for organizations. So there are a lot of new companies that don't even have any servers anymore. They go straight to the cloud, either Amazon, AWS, Azure, or some organizations, if they're small enough, rely entirely on SaaS solutions or PaaS, PaaS solutions, I guess.
Platform as a service, yeah.
I don't know if I've ever said that out loud before, PaaS before, but but this article, he's really talking about more infrastructure as a service versus the other two.
And oh, you're right. I don't think I've ever said infrastructure as a service. What was that, IaaS?
IaaS. The second point that reason that he believes that this is necessary is that what's going on is a concentration of services. So there's three or four large cloud computing providers. Of course, AWS and Azure and Google are three of the top ones in that list. And he is concerned that because there are only a few vendors at the top of this pyramid, that mistakes made or trade-offs that they've decided to make within their architectural design and infrastructure are going to lead to widespread problems for potentially millions of people and thousands of companies. You could kind of see this playing out a little bit in the not too recent past, where it seemed like every week you were reading an article about default S3 bucket configurations leading to data mishandling or data leaks. So Bruce's solution is for government regulation. And we'll get into that a little bit more. I'm more of a free market person, so I look at this from a different perspective. Because I'm kind of thinking and looking at this saying that, all right, if there are gaps in the security provided by these cloud providers, there's actually a market opportunity there for aftermarket security organizations helping secure those platforms, your company cloud environments. And it seems like this would be a natural compensating control, which would evolve and has evolved to some extent up through the market. And there's a similar corresponding thing that we've seen with micro patches. Now, there's a company called Zero Patch, which produces what they call micro patches for Microsoft Windows. And they produce patches much more rapidly than Microsoft does themselves when a zero-day vulnerability is released. And they also go and produce patches or micro patches for vulnerabilities in platforms which Microsoft no longer supports. So they'll produce Windows 7 patches. I think at least in the past, they've done XP patches for vulnerabilities, which have been exposed after the shelf life or the end of life for those other operating systems. So I see that as a corresponding security result or market result for a gap which exists. Now, the reason that Bruce says that the cloud providers aren't going to be providing the security that people would expect is that the incentive to do so is not there. And he also gives two reasons for this. The first one being that the externalities of breaches are largely borne by the users.
And the company. So they usually have to pay a bunch of money to some company to come in and, you know, clean things up and give them a clean bill of health.
Well, I think that's who he's considering, the users.
Oh, right. The customers, the cloud environment. It's not right. The customers, the customers. Sorry.
Right. And reading through the whole article, I believe he is really focusing on the IaaS providers. And in considering this statement that losses are due to data breaches largely borne by the users, I'm trying to think back of an instance where an actual failure of a cloud provider's security infrastructure led to a compromise. A misconfigured S3 bucket, which is the responsibility of the user, is not really AWS's fault.
No. I think if you go and you look at the AWS compliance model, like the security shared responsibility model, all the stuff that's typically compromised, you know, the operating system, the firewalls, the authentication, the networking traffic and protection, all that's still the responsibility of the customer.
The second point that he references are that investors don't punish cloud service companies for their failures.
Well, is it their failure? I mean, again, if you look at the shared responsibility model, they're telling you it's all on you. We're not really doing anything.
And I agree with that. I think he's misconstruing something here in that investors haven't been punishing other companies for breaches, Target, Sony, Home Depot, et cetera.
Yeah, it's turning into it's a sale now, right? They get breached, their stock goes on sale for a couple of weeks.
Right. It's an opportunity for investors, really. So I think he's a little, I don't want to say confused, but I think he's conflating two things together.
Look at you. Colin, Bruce, and I are confused. I mean,
and
I guess
maybe I should have started this off by saying I am a huge Bruce Schneier fan, by the way.
You know, what occurs to me here, though, is what level of responsibility is he expecting the cloud services companies to take? They're providing a service. They provide you with complex documentation and complex systems for sure to secure your own environment. And then they give you the shared responsibility model, which says you're really responsible for all of it. Go have fun. Is he expecting them to treat them more like, you know, kids in a candy store where you got to keep them at arm's length and, you know, hold on to them at all times?
It kind of seems that way. It's kind of like back to the old days of the coal miners and the company store kind of thing, where the company has all the power and the consumers of that product have no power. And unless someone steps in and forces the company to do the right thing, then they remove the agency from the customers. Customers don't have the responsibility to look out for themselves. They're not smart enough to look out for themselves.
You know what? That's the exact same argument the U.S. government is giving right now for like breaking up big tech. I was just reading it was in Reason this month where they were talking about how the government's trying to break up big tech, and they do the exact same thing. Where they're saying that, you know, you have to use Facebook, and Facebook is all everywhere. And if you're not using Facebook, like ignoring the fact that lots of people can and do delete their Facebook accounts or move to different social networks or whatever.
Or I've never had a Facebook account.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's really the same thing for cloud providers. You don't have to go to the cloud.
No, and there's competitors. There's at least four competitors, five competitors that I'm aware of, and probably lots of like small to mid-sized companies. I think though, going back to what you're saying about the companies themselves. We talked about this a little bit, so economist Milton Friedman said the firm's sole responsibility is to its shareholders, and it's, you know, primary, you know, for whatever level of morality that a company has, the goal is to maximize returns to shareholders. So in terms of security in the cloud, a lot of companies are just, you know, you move to the cloud, which moves your expenses from CapEx to OpEx, so you can deduct it more easily. And you don't do security because that's a cost center.
Well, there's two sides of that, because the idea is that if you're an organization that's making profit, then you've been chosen in the marketplace by consumers as who they want to deal with. It's a voluntary transaction.
And you take the hit whenever you do get compromised. And it's probably cheaper to just fix things from then forward. I don't know exactly what the cost is, but what a decent security system might cost for 10 years. What if you can avoid being breached for 15 and then you get caught and yeah, you get a breach and yeah, you got to spin up a security group, but that's 15 years of payments you didn't have to make.
You know, profits that were may have been reinvested in the company to do other things and make the company larger, hire more employees, produce different and better products, more R&D. There are all sorts of different aspects to that.
Until the breach actually costs companies, like what was the cost of the target breach? Was it in the hundreds of millions?
I am not sure.
Target breach cost $162 million. Target profits 2013. They made $72 billion in sales. Fourth quarterly net earnings of $520 million. Full year net earnings of $2 billion. So $165 million was definitely a hit on that, but that's not an enormous part. And that's only happened to them once in the 20 plus years.
Right. So the question they had to ask themselves is, should we have spent more on security in order to reduce that number?
Yeah. So, let's assume that it happens once every 20 years. That's $8 million a year you'd have to spend to equal that.
Well, see, you might say that was a mistake on their part then, because are they now spending more than $8 million a year on security as a result of this?
Yeah, I'm sure they've got some calculations somewhere for, you know, reputational damage and how many sales they lost that year from people going to Walmart instead. Anyways, I think I took us off on a tangent.
A little bit. But this is something you had suggested that we were talking about how investors don't punish the cloud companies, is that this might be an opportunity for activist investors. An opportunity there. And I think this kind of relates to the GameStop hedge fund gambit a few weeks ago.
Yeah, let's get Wall Street Bets in on this.
So, I mean, it's possible for that kind of thing to happen.
I mean, because the reason that I added that is I'm somewhat familiar that there are environmental activist investor groups that are coming in and, you know, buying a certain amount of shares to get votes and then trying to throw around some weight on company boards and try to elect people to company boards to push a more environmentalist agenda. Seems to me that if you're really passionate about security, you can do that too. You can, I don't know if you need a fund to do this, or, you know, you'd have to be rich at least.
Well, or have a motivated group of people whose combined wealth would facilitate that.
And I got like $100 I can throw in.
Hey, I got 2 nickels.
Oh, man.
I can rub them together even.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd see that as being, it's not, environmentalism has such a huge kind of moral cachet behind it. I don't know if you could get that same level of moral cachet behind security. People believe in environmentalism.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got security people who are passionate about security, but I'm not sure they're that passionate about security.
Not enough to put their money where their mouth is.
Which is what they're suggesting these cloud companies do.
Well, again, it's the same thing with the cloud companies. If it's not costing them, like you said before, like if a breach happens on their stuff, it's almost always the company that's at fault. They don't get any blowback. I haven't even heard of anybody being like, oh, you know, well, why doesn't him, why, you know, like this capital breach happened. Why isn't Amazon being brought up and charged and fined? Well, because it's not their fault.
Right. I would almost relate it to motor vehicles, where most motor vehicle accidents occur due to human error versus faulty mechanical systems in the vehicles themselves. Not that that doesn't happen, but most of the time it's not the vehicle manufacturer's problem, or their mistakes on their part did not lead to the accident.
With a couple, well, I wouldn't even say this is an exception. I was when we were looking at this, I wrote down a note about the Pinto and the Ford Motor Company, where they made a market-based decision back in, what, like 1970-something, that rather than making the Pinto safer and, you know, adding a couple bucks with the protection stuff, they calculated the cost of the lawsuits would probably be less than the cost of fixing it. I mean, cloud companies are probably making, maybe not an explicit calculation, but they're kind of making that calculation when they choose how many, you know, security engineers to hire. And companies are definitely making that calculation when they choose how big to make their security program.
As well as going to the cloud.
Yeah.
I mean, as been said numerous times, security is really about trade-offs.
Yeah, it's not like we don't know how to do security. We could make, for all the jokes about the only secure Windows computer is one that's shut off and, you know, unplugged, like, we know how to make a secure system, you know. Limit the incoming traffic to only what you know is correct and should be there. You know, remove admin rights. To go to application whitelisting on every system. Track and baseline your entire network so you know what's supposed to be talking to what, and, you know, alert if something weird happens and chase it down. We just don't do it because it's expensive and it's slow and it's cumbersome and the business hates that. And I get that. I am not saying the business is wrong. I'm not saying that's how we should do security. I'm just saying that we make, every company knowingly makes that decision every time they implement a new system. Nobody stops and is like, all right, we're going to figure out exactly what this does. We're going to whitelist everything. We're going to figure out exactly what connections it makes. They throw it in there and they tell security, all right, we just bought this new system. Make it work with your monitoring.
Right.
Anyways, onward. I don't know where you want to.
I mean, we'll continue on with what Bruce has got to say about the issue with the cloud providers. So one of the things that he mentioned is that public information about cloud security generally doesn't share design trade-offs in building these cloud services or provide much transparency about the resulting risks.
I don't know that most people would care, honestly, like most of the customers.
Well, there may be people that read those papers and there may be those that don't, but let's say that they were fully transparent about their decisions in their infrastructure design. Well, what would be the result of that transparency? Nothing. Now, would we end up with with AWS saying, hey, we're going to design our infrastructure this way, and end up with a bunch of replies or other security specialists coming in and saying, hey, well, you're not thinking about this, you're not thinking about that, maybe you should do it this way versus that way, and maybe end up with an overall more secure infrastructure because AWS opened themselves up to public comment on their infrastructure. I think what would more likely happen is that AWS would come out and say, this is our infrastructure design, and this is the reason that we made this decision. And they would get a lot of feedback saying, oh, well, you're wrong. I disagree with that decision. You should have done this. And because there isn't necessarily a right way and a wrong way, there are different ways to do things. What you'd end up with is AWS saying we want to do it this way, and a reasonably large group saying, given valid reasons why they should do it differently. And either that would, AWS would simply ignore them, in which case, what was the value in the exercise? Or they would get tied up in committee, or they would constantly change their infrastructure to meet what was being published on, or what kind of feedback they got from the security community. And if they did that as well, would that mean that the people who provided input to that infrastructure design are then entitled to some of the profits from AWS because they provided that information? I think it's the overall idea sounds good on the surface, but I think it's fraught with challenges and would end up being not overall beneficial for them to be that open about what they're doing with their infrastructure.
Is this somewhat similar to kind of how companies have boards of people from different industries that come in and, you know, give them advice and kind of lead the company? We're like having almost like a security board of people that aren't employed by the company that can come in and give kind of direction and external information and they can represent those customers.
Sure, but what that would simply be an extension of their current practice.
Hmm.
You know, they may see value in getting additional expertise or references to provide feedback on that infrastructure, but it's not public. It still would not be public where all the customers or consumers of the cloud platform then get to see and hear about the trade-offs and the infrastructure and all that.
Hmm.
So, like I said, it sounds like a good idea on the surface, but I don't think it's a really a wise decision for companies to go down that path. Now, one of the other bottom line things that Bruce references here is the aggregation of cybersecurity creating a risk to national security.
Oh, no. Drink.
Really? I mean, national security is really just a euphemism for maintaining the power of the current oligarchs.
Not pulling any punches, are you?
Not usually, no. But what he's suggesting is that there should be clear expectations for the security cloud services and for decisions and trade-offs about that security to be transparent. And he's suggesting that the Biden administration, with their new National Cyber Director, Chris English, should create an interagency task force to work with the providers in order to review their threat models and evaluate the security architecture of their various offerings. And I don't necessarily think that's all that great idea. The government, it's not like the government has perfect security or does security perfectly. So they have NIST, FedRAMP, and other tools that cloud providers can take advantage of or be evaluated against versus having the government come in and do basically an assessment on all the cloud providers and indicate whether they're good or not. He also suggests that there should be a push to modernize cybersecurity regulations for the cloud era. I don't know exactly what that means because cybersecurity regulations is kind of nebulous.
Yeah, and frankly, again, going back to the shared responsibility model, like the companies are in charge of most of the important layers anyways. I get, you know, the cloud can be just somebody else's computer and it can be other stuff too, like, you know, software running code as a service and things like that. But all that stuff is still on the company.
And you consider that the more regulation you add on, the more expensive that makes cloud computing as well.
Yeah. And frankly, the regulations are always going to be 15, 20 years behind anyways, right?
Well, regulations can probably move a little bit faster because it's not actually a law. Federal agencies simply write these things down and then companies have to abide by them. If you're talking about actually changing the law, then you're talking about a lot larger effort to do that.
That's fair. Yeah, I don't know. A lot of this I feel like is just doing regular security in the cloud. Now, admittedly, you know, the more I think about it, though, stuff like Lambda, stuff, some of the newer, fancier stuff certainly doesn't match what you're doing on-prem, and maybe it does require some new level of regulations, but I don't know if that's exactly what he's saying here.
Well, I don't think Lambda needs to be regulated. It might need to be understood in a different context from a engineering or architecture perspective. I'm not sure that should be regulated.
Yeah.
Now, he's thinking that a lot of this could be done through FedRAMP, which is the Federal Risk and Authorization Management Program. This is mostly focused on individual services rather than the architectural choices of the vendor. So he believes that this should be modified to take those architectural decisions more into account. And he's also suggesting that Congress does get involved and reinforce and extend executive orders, you know, presidential decrees, by adding new obligations for vendors to provide transparency about design, trade-offs, and threat models. And the more they pile on here, the more it sounds like, you know, maybe the government should just nationalize the cloud providers. You know, then they wouldn't have to worry about transparency and all this, because they would be doing the correct job behind the scenes. Because if they nationalize the cloud providers, then they could throw transparency out the window to the customers, because it would be national secret at that point. And you could just assume that the government's doing the right thing behind the scenes.
Yeah, because the government always does the right thing behind the scenes.
And he's suggesting that all this in total is really comes down to the reason that the government has to get involved with regulations, laws and regulations, is that this is a market failure, that the cloud security companies or the cloud providers are not providing adequate security for their customers.
And I guess this is where I just really completely disagree with them. I don't think it's the cloud provider's responsibility to protect, like, that none of the, I mean, am I missing like a big breach that relied on something that AWS did or Google Cloud did?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, there have been mistakes that have been made by the cloud providers that have had wide-reaching impacts.
Yeah, you mentioned before the S3 buckets by default just being open to everybody. Yeah, that was a mistake, but that was something the company could have fixed as well.
Right. Well, there was that misconfiguration by that AWS engineer that took down the East Coast a few years ago. But that's human error. That's not a fundamental architectural misstep or misdesign by AWS.
Is he saying that the architectural misstep is that the security is being pushed off to the companies? Like, is that what he's saying? Is that the cloud providers should assume more of the shared responsibility model by default and just like make it secure by default when people spin up something on AWS?
That seems to be the inference, though he doesn't come right out and say that.
Yeah, it's clouded in lots of talk about how the greater transparency and security engineering trade-offs and kind of what seems to me to be kind of generic language rather than, you know, coming out and talking specifically.
Well, he also wrote this for politicians. I mean, this was in Foreign Policy magazine, and he republished it on his blog. So this isn't really directed at you or I or other security professionals. This is directed at government policymakers and asking them to step in.
All right. So here's my problem with that, though. I don't really understand what he's asking for. And if I don't understand what he's asking for, how are the government policymakers going to understand what he's asking for? Although I guess that you could say that about a lot of the laws and things that are passed.
Well, he's asking for one thing clearly, and this is all the policy makers need to hear, is more government involvement. That's really the bottom line.
Fair enough.
You know, and I'm looking at this thinking that he's calling this a market failure, but if it's a market failure, I think it's a miscategorization, because if it's a market failure that the cloud providers are not bearing the costs of security breaches, does this not already mean that it hasn't been a failure of the market, but a failure of courts to properly rule in cases against these providers to hold them liable for their mistakes?
I have no problem with, holding them liable for their mistakes. I just haven't heard of any of the mistakes that have really been a major issue.
Yeah, because this seems like he's trying to get in front of it, saying we need to address this before it happens, before those mistakes bring the nation to its knees because of these few vendors are failing to provide adequate security. And I'm kind of wondering if, you know, there isn't an opportunity here for like a Consumer Reports for cloud computing to, you know, not exact, a star rating is probably a little bit simplistic, but saying that, you know, we compared Google with AWS with Azure based on this, this, and this, and this means that AWS overall is a better security thing. or provides better security than Google, for instance. But why does this really matter for most organizations? And I think this is gives a couple of things for companies who are moving to the cloud or considering moving to the cloud to think about is, can you rely on the cloud providers to provide a certain level of security? And I think you have to say that, you know, you are going to provide them with a certain level of trust. But going back to what we talked about a little bit ago, it's critical for any organization that's going to the cloud to understand the shared responsibility model for cloud vendors, for infrastructure as a service, platform as a service, software as a service, container as a service now. And there are a lot of resources out there to help you understand that model of what it means for you, as well as the arguments pro and con about whether the cloud is actually more secure than a locally built data center. But ultimately, it's up to the customer to decide whether it's worth that, worth it for them to go to the cloud, knowing what they do know about the cloud provider they're considering. Bruce says they are not transparent enough, but if they aren't transparent enough, that also means that the customer does not have enough information in order to make an adequate decision. And that can be informed or should be something that a customer can use to inform their decision.
Yeah, I think a lot of that fault again, but that fault goes back to the customer for rolling into the cloud without even knowing. That's the source of a lot of lift and shift deployments where they just treat the cloud like another data center and don't take advantage of any of the, you know, scripting or services that are available to them.
Right. It's, well, I would not say it's entirely misplaced concept to say that a cloud provider is another data center. It's a virtual data center. It provides almost the same thing you would get in a colo, just virtual versus physical.
Yeah, and you can certainly treat it that way. It's not ideal. It's not the best way to treat it, but it's a way. All right. Anything else you want to say about this one?
No, I don't think so.
All righty. Now for something a little more fun. Ethereum, crypto mining. So Norton 360 antivirus announced this week. I think it was this week. I don't know. We do these every couple of weeks, so who knows what week it was. That they are now going to let you mine Ethereum with Norton 360. We're going to go ahead and file this under WTF. It's super weird. They have added the ability to mine Ethereum within the AV product itself. Their announcement was that this was to protect users from malicious mining software because apparently some number of users disable their antivirus to install a miner. I can imagine that most benign miners are fine. I guess they have to disable the AV to implant like a Trojan or a fake crypto miner.
But even if you need to disable the AV in order to allow a crypto miner to function, Norton could also provide documentation and say, here's how you do make an exception for files and folders on your system.
Yeah, but we'll see in a minute why they don't do that. So the users join a Norton mining pool. They will either deposit the cryptocurrency into a Norton wallet for you in the cloud. This is also to help protect you because they said that a lot of when your hard drive crashes, you know, you're going to lose your coins. So it's better if we keep it in the cloud for you. Or, you know, you can put it in a personal wallet if you want to. And it only runs when the GPU is not already being used. So that's good. That's nice of them. So my first thought is, does it even make sense to mine Ethereum on your average home PC? I went ahead and I took a look at a Tom's Hardware article on the top 20 graphics cards today, and then I ran them. I grabbed the top one, I grabbed the bottom one, I grabbed one in the middle, and just threw them on there to take a look at the nice hash calculator. And the top range card right now, the NVIDIA RTX 3090, it costs $1,500. It will get you $7.07 of profit per day at an average cost of 10 cents per kilowatt for your electricity. That is a 200 plus day return on investment there. Although I guess it'd probably provide you with a profit after that. An NVIDIA RTX 3060 at $329 is $2.90 profit. That's a better return on investment. investment, that's only something like 110 days before you get your money back. The lowest end graphics card on there, a 4 gig AMD RX 5500, was $1 a day in profit. At only $170, that's still half a year to get back profit and then turn it around.
Oh, that's so assuming you get all the profit.
Well, yeah, we'll talk about that in a second. But I'm curious to know how this goes with the only runs when idle. I mean, I guess most computers probably run in idle most of the day if you leave them on. So you probably won't make quite this level of profit, but maybe you'll make, you know, a significant percentage of it. I also found another article from CoinDesk that reported that Norton's going to take 15% right off the top as part of the mining pool. So as I understand it, the average cryptocurrency mining pool, judging by Investopedia, typically pools charge between 1% and 3%. So Norton is taking an extra 12 to 14% off the top for providing you with this capability. So that's a nice little get for Norton. I mean, if we assume the mid-range processor, actually we should probably assume the bottom range processor, that is 15 cents per day.
You know, maybe they're going about this a little bit wrong. So
a little bit.
I'm thinking about from their perspective, in that, is this their paid product or is this their free product?
You know what? I don't actually know. Which product was this? This was Norton 360 antivirus.
Because I'm thinking if it's a paid profit, maybe they have an option where they or the paid product, they all give an option where you don't have to buy it. We'll give it to you for free, but it runs as crypto miner.
That's really interesting, actually. There is a premium Norton 360 because on Amazon, you can buy it for $30.
So,
but yeah, that makes more sense to take 15% off the top or even more if you pay ahead or pay as you go.
Right. So they could give away the premium product and use the crypto mining to offset what they just gave away.
I mean, if it's a, let's say the worst graphics card there is kind of our baseline, because I imagine a lot of the people that are using Norton are using on their home PCs and they're using their, you know, Walmart purchased laptops or desktops. That's 15 cents a day times 360 days a year is what, $90 a year? No, divide by six, $60 a year. Something like that, approximately. That's a pretty good take for them. And if you've got a more powerful machine, hey, that's just more money. 300 plus bucks a year if they've got a really powerful GPU.
Yeah, I'm wondering if this isn't the tip of the iceberg as far as not necessarily AV vendors, but software vendors in general.
So Norton has 21 million customers with 60% of them using Norton 360. So yeah, that they could 100% transform their revenue stream into just taking 15% off the top. That's a really good idea. All right, well, let's talk about that in a minute, because I actually had some notes on that. So the other thing that I found was wear and tear on the machine. A lot of sources, I said that if you keep the temperatures under control, mining doesn't really destroy your PC, you know, force it to break earlier. It's only if you, you know, drive at 100% all the time. Now, I don't know if that's taken into account in the nice hash counts. I don't know if those were, you know, running at 100% power until it melts on you, or if they were expecting, you know, keeping the temperatures under control. So depending on how Norton does it, that may not be an issue. All right. So yeah, so let's talk about kind of the business model behind this. I think that's really interesting to use that. You're basically trading the life of your PC and your electricity usage against another product. What other products do you think would like look at this type of model? I mean, SETI at Home did it, but that was basically free. You weren't getting anything from it. There's the Folding at Home doing it for the proteins where you're using volunteers, but both of those were opt-in and both of those were kind of volunteer type things.
I think you're looking at anything that really that has a large install base where pooling cryptocurrency mining makes sense.
Microsoft, yeah, you have to have the lot. Yeah.
Microsoft Office, Outlook, Steam.
Oh my gosh. Can you imagine if games on Steam were free and you just had to let them mine? Because that's actually an even better one, because people that play games will have a better GPU set.
Yeah, assuming they're not crazy and are gaming 20 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of idle time for the gaming PC. Because assuming they have a dedicated gaming PC and not, that's not also, you know, a workstation. So,
well, even still, like a lot of, even if you have a gaming PC, like you still probably work 8 hours during the day. So you can probably assume getting at least 8 hours for work and 8 hours for sleep.
Well, I'm thinking that when I say dedicated gaming PC, I mean, it is not used for anything except gaming, which means it's probably idle for 20 hours.
Could be, yeah.
Or, you know, or more a day.
Well, I mean, even idle is, like, if I'm surfing the web, does that count as idle? Because you can probably use 50, 60, 70% of the GPU without affecting other performances until they spin up certain tasks.
Yeah, if you're talking about just the GPU, then yes, versus the core processor.
Yeah, I'm looking at my two GPUs. Well, it's using the Intel. I've got a laptop with two. So yeah, it's using the Intel onboard graphics right now for, you know, displaying web pages and stuff. And it's not even touching the GeForce. So something could be running that right now in the background for mining. Ah, I'm missing out.
Here goes your retirement. It's gone.
All right. So we've definitely seen this in the past. We saw a CoinHive doing this on websites where you could sign up and you could put their JavaScript on and it would use computers, CPUs, and GPUs when they were on the website. You just mentioned yourself, David, this could be a future business model for kind of premium, free or premium products. I see it more, definitely falling more in the gaming space, but mining on phones, that's not something that has been done yet that I know about. I could see installing, you know, an app or something, especially, oh God, the whole freemium games on the, can you imagine being like that stupid, those stupid like Ebony games or something where, you know, you build the houses or like the Sim City game where you build it. It's like, this will take 24 hours, you know, pay $1.50 to speed it up immediately. Can you imagine that being like, let us use your phone for crypto mining for the next 24 hours?
Yeah, actually, I've not heard about an app doing that, but hackers have used phones for crypto mining.
Ooh. That is an interesting choice. All right, so vendors competing for the GPU. What happens when you get multiple vendors that want to come in and they want you to give them the GPU? And they do they just suck it up? Or are they going to try and take over 100% of the GPU and fight each other for it?
You're probably going to get an incompatibility list or incompatibility error. Try to install a piece of software like, oh, cannot install because X is installed and running or something like that. That would be my guess, but they would have to, the vendors would then have to stay on top of other products, or they would have to be check the GPU maybe when they install to see if some other miner is taking advantage of the GPU or something like that.
Yeah. Maybe. I can also see having them, having you put in a credit card when you sign up too, just in case, you know, you weasel your way out of it somehow. Like you install like 10 different programs and all try and crypto mine, and each one gets 10 cents instead of a dollar.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be interesting if this is something that turns out to be successful for Norton.
I don't know. What do you think the chances are of another vendor doing this within 3 months?
I would wait till the end of the quarter to look at the numbers from Norton's profits.
Gotcha.
I think once the profit numbers are released, then other vendors will have a frame of reference to see if it's a profitable model or not.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm thinking, because again, going back to the calculations, it looks like they might be able to get about $1 a week per computer if all the computers have fairly low-end graphics processors. So with, you know,
the 20 million install 12, base?
No, that's 60% of 20 million, so 12 million install base. Yeah, so that might be an extra $60 million next year.
That's a nice chunk of change.
Yeah, yeah.
I wouldn't turn it down.
No. All right, so why does this matter? Well, first of all, if you want to do mining, hold out for a better cut. Norton is ripping you off, taking 15%. Wait till, and that's going to be interesting to see them kind of drive it down. I wonder at what percentage it becomes, like it stays profitable for them. Like, it, you know, if they're taking 1% off the top, now you're at a penny a day, 7 cents a year, 30 cents a month, you know, $1.20 a quarter. Like that's a lot less than, you know, making $50 a year, $60 a year.
Actually, now that I think about it, the AV vendors that are already free, Aghast, some of those other ones, or Avast, some of those other ones might jump on this right away.
Yeah, I can see that, since they're not making any money anyways.
Well, they're making some kind of profit. I'm not sure about what the revenue stream is, but this would increase it.
Yeah. So what should you do about this? Well, first of all, you should pay a little attention to how they're making money off you, especially like David just mentioned, if you're that old saying, if you're not paying for it, then you're the product. Be an intelligent product. Be the product you want to be. And don't give money to companies that are taking advantage of you. If you want to mine cryptocurrency, don't give Norton 15%. Do a regular crypto mining pool. Make sure you download a good piece of software that is, you know, vetted and is widely accepted as legitimate, and make those exceptions in Norton so that you can do your crypto mining. And with that, we are done. That looks like that's all the articles we have for today. Thank you for joining us. Follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.